You know, last week, Wisconsin saw its first snowfall of the season, and I'm sure it's a sign of more to come. Down the road, Larry Beeler here. The weather guys are back. That voice you might have heard just now, John Martin, with me in the studio, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
And with us by phone today, Steve Ackerman, former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back to you.
It's great to be back. I am one of those people who is traveling that you just reported on.
Well, I want to talk to you in just a minute, but I want to remind our listeners here, if you have a question, weather, climate question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And, Steve, I want to go to you first. You're out west, and I was thinking about atmospheric rivers this morning, and I looked online, and sure enough, right now, the state of California is getting hit by an atmospheric river. Can you tell us anything about it? Is it hitting any areas where you are?
I'm going to let John get into the atmospheric river part and those storms that are occurring, because he just gave a really great talk on Friday about that. But, the atmospheric rivers are associated with the jet stream. The West Coast, up and down the West Coast, California, is getting precipitation. San Francisco flooded yesterday, I think it was, pretty bad. Where I am, we're in the southwest. Southeast corner of the state of Washington, and we got a lot of fog here this morning, but we haven't had any precipitation yet.
Well, John, let me turn to you then. Yeah. Explain what's going on with this atmospheric river.
Yeah, I'll have to say right off the top that I'm not a fan of that term. I think the term has become overused, and the media jumps all over it as if it were a brand new discovery. And the fact is that it's a really good concept to say that a substantial amount of water vapor flows from the tropics to the extratropics in narrow corridors in the atmosphere. And that's interesting and very important to understand. But every time one of these so-called atmospheric rivers dumps a lot of rain on the West Coast states, particularly California, it's a function of the development of weather systems that engender and encourage that northward transport of water vapor. So they're really not a new thing. They're kind of a new discovery that a lot of the water vapor comes in a narrow little highway, transport highway. But they're tied to extratropical cyclones, which we understand pretty well and can make now, in this modern era, reasonable predictions of. So people don't get surprised by these things. However, the amounts of rain are extraordinary because this is a tropical moisture plume that gets thrown up against the high terrain of the Sierra. And if you're below freezing, it's liquid water. And if you're above freezing, it's snow. And places in Northern California late last week had, or actually over the weekend as well, had over 100 inches of snow widespread. And that's about a seventh of their entire season. It can come in one event. So these things are really impactful for the water budget of the state of California, which matters to all of us because, you know, if you eat fruits and vegetables, you're eating stuff from California.
and it never makes it to Wisconsin, that river that we're talking about.
That's correct, because that's going to be wrung out as it goes over the Rocky Mountains. And the first encounter is the Sierra Madre, Sierra Nevada. And then it can't get all the way across the high terrain. It gets wrung out.
Well, here's a question that I don't know if I can even pronounce it all. Stephanie from Thiensville emailed to ask you to speak about the Beaufort-Geyer release and its connection to Atlantic meridional overturning circulation.
Oh, yeah, the Beaufort-Geyer, I think, is probably
what
it is.
Is that what it is? Beaufort-Geyer?
It's one of the oceanic circulation features that is kind of a standing feature in the North Atlantic. And so we talk about this so-called Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. Meridional is an adjective that means north-south.
Okay.
And Atlantic is geographic. So it's a north-south overturning circulation of water in the Atlantic basin. And it's controlled by lots of interesting small components that work in concert to drive it rather substantially and keep the Gulf Stream pumping poleward on the east coast of North America. One of the factors is cold air that funnels off of the Canadian archipelago and the high latitudes of the north through the mouth of the Labrador Sea. That really not only cools the water at the mouth of the Labrador Sea, which is south of Greenland, but also creates enormous amounts of evaporation, which makes the water fresher and more and less dense. And so you have these competing effects of trying to pump cold, dense water downward at the mouth of the Labrador Sea that kind of primes the whole circulation and then sends tropical warm water poleward. If the one of the pieces of the puzzle in this Atlantic meridional overturning circulation were to suddenly stop contributing for one reason or another, you would have potentially very rapid shifts in the way that warm water is pumped poleward in the North Atlantic. And that could change a lot about the regional climates of eastern North America and western Europe. And so there's some threat that could happen.
And so some sea level rise could occur?
Maybe the opposite. Maybe there'd be more ice, and so the water would freeze up a little bit and not raise the sea level, but make it a lot colder in places like Iceland and London and Sweden and Norway northern France and Spain than it is right now. So that's a possibility.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls has a question for us. Let's go there. Okay. Hi, Kurt.
Okay, thanks. I'm wondering if we in this country, at least 20, 30 years ago, had seriously the financial costs incurred through climate change, global warming. Is there a way of calculating the money that would have been saved, or put another way, the money that we have lost on treating storm events and so on and so forth over the last several decades? Is there a way of calculating a number for that?
Steve, what do you think?
I'm not an economist, but I know that there have been estimates with what is the cost to individuals and to nations due to climate change that has occurred in the last 20, 30 years and also out into the future. The challenge to do that is to be able to look at a weather event, you know, from the weather perspective, you know, like the flooding we had in North Carolina, and then be able to attribute that to the climate change that has occurred and then look at that cost to ameliorate what those effects were, and to is also in the other area, but then also to try and look at, okay, what those costs were in relation to what were the costs back to 20, 30 years ago if we try to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions. So there is a way, and I know that there are economists that look at that, but I don't know what those costs specifically are.
Yeah,
I don't either. And I think I've talked to some people who deal with forecasts and reinsurance and the primary insurance industry, and they would definitely agree, Steve, that whether you count the number of events or the cost of those events or some mix of the two, they would be able to tell you at the end of the day that 20 or 30 years ago, insurance companies could stay in business at a certain rate premium that they cannot stay in business at anymore when it has to do with weather-related insurance. And there's no way that those people are being confused. You know, you talk to insurance and reinsurance agents, they know the climate's changing and it's impacting their business. It's impacting the viability of their business, in fact, and in a very serious way. So I would guess that they would be really good people to talk to get an answer to this question. And it strikes me that, you know, it brings up the old story of the big difference between spending and investment. You know, willy-nilly spending is maybe something we want to try to avoid as a nation, but investment is not something we want to try to avoid as a nation. And I think, you know, if you're investing in trying to recoup losses in the 30 or 50-year time frame, we're unfortunately behind where we would be, but this doesn't mean we shouldn't start now.
Yeah.
On a personal level, you know, when Madison got flooded back in 2011, I think it was.
Yeah.
I ended up taking out flood insurance because we live near the water, one of the water bodies. And this past year, you know, it almost doubled the flood insurance for our house, you know, to the point where I was trying to ascertain whether or not it was worth it.
Yeah.
We ended up getting it, but again, it's that balance of, okay, it's gone up, it's doubled. Now what do I do about that?
Yeah. You know, and I heard this from a couple of people in that industry, and they say, you know, it's not just the cost of insuring, it's the cost of replacement that makes a lot of their book cost more to replace than it does to insure. And that's when they go under. They can't do that. And, you know, buying plywood and buying all the rest of the lumber and building supplies is too expensive to make up for the losses that people are experiencing. And this is a very serious problem. It's looming. I'm sure people in North Carolina have already dealt with it. And we're going to all hear about it more, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Thanks for that comment. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So my question is, we typically the Earth goes through glacial periods about every, I think, 40,000 years, and we were due to go into another one. Do we know from ice cores or other geological data how quickly that transition might have occurred if there hadn't been global warming? Would it have been like a light switch, and 1 year we had spring, summer, and fall, and then the next year we had perpetual winter? Or is it more like a dimmer where over centuries it would have transitioned?
Oh,
yeah, that's a good question. I think you put it in nice terms. I think it's definitely the second. It's over centuries. We can look back through those ice cores. And the cool thing about the ice cores is, you know, anybody who's gone skating on the lakes here in town or anywhere in this part of the country realizes that if you go out, put your skates on, you're going to find little bubbles of air in the ice. Sometimes they're so big you got to avoid those spots. But those bubbles of air have exactly the same composition chemically as the air that you're breathing as you skate across the lake. And so this is what we do with these ice cores. We find bubbles in the ice that are 800,000 or a million years old, and you can bring that air that's in the bubbles into the laboratory with sophisticated equipment and count what the molecular makeup is of that air. And you can thereby measure the carbon dioxide fraction. Mm. And it goes up and down over that long geological time. At least in the last million or so years, it's gone from highs of around 300 molecules per million to lows of about 180. And those swings up and down are naturally occurring, but they're spread out over between 75 and 100,000 years. They take a long time to come about. So the dramatic increase that we've seen in the carbon dioxide fraction in our atmosphere now that's occurred since about 1850, it's gone up to 422 parts per million, well above the last million-year long-term average. And it's increased by, 200 or so percent in that 150-ish years. And so this is not related to some natural variability. And we're seeing this is like a light switch, but the background variability is definitely not like a light switch.
Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW, our guests today. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us. On WPR News, Larry Mueller here talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And as a reminder, if you miss a part of our show, you want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts. So just a little point of information. Right now, if you have a climate and weather question, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have a question. Weather patterns and climate change, aren't they the same thing? And if a weather pattern is a weather pattern, we really can't do nothing about a weather pattern, can we?
Well, that's an excellent question. Steve, you want to go after that?
I'll start and then turn it over to you. But I agree, it's an excellent question because they are interlinked. So when we think of climate, we think of it as the collective state of the atmosphere for a given place over a specified interval of time. And that's why you'll hear us, our phrases like the urban climate. So we're talking about the climate of a city, or global climate, which is where we're talking about, obviously, the globe climate.
when we talk about climate change, we're looking at the long-term change in average weather patterns as well as changes in the climate, because as Mary Kay is pointing out, they are tied together. How the patterns, the idea of the weather patterns is to move energy around in the atmosphere in order to try and balance off the increased amount of energy we're getting in the tropics from the sun versus the energy we're losing at the polar regions. So the weather patterns and the ocean patterns are trying to move that energy around. And so the climate and the weather patterns are very much linked together. Very hard to do anything about weather patterns. In fact, I would say we cannot do things about weather patterns. We do change the climate, and I think generally unintentionally. I think when we started building the cities, we weren't thinking about how that's going to affect that local climate. And the same thing now with carbon dioxide emissions, although now we know that they are changing the climate. And the question is, what can we do about that?
Yeah. John, to add to that?
Yeah, it's a good description. I think the way I like to think about this is that the climate sets the background rules for the way the weather will evolve. And so, you know, the nature of the climate is, you know, let's talk about particularly the carbon dioxide fraction as one element of the background rules. When that's gone up, that's created an environment that allows for a set of possibilities today that didn't exist as much 100 or 200 years ago. And the average weather of today, therefore, reflects that range of new possibilities. And, you know, and therefore, when you look at the average weather as a means to describe the climate, it makes perfect sense because the climate is setting the rules in which those weather patterns can develop. So I think about it this way. When we come to the main part of your question about can we do anything about climate or the weather? You know, I love baseball, and right now the bases are 90 feet apart. If by some fiat, some rule, they were changed to be 80 feet apart, you'd suddenly see people having a higher batting average. Everything about the complexion of the game would change because something about the background rules was changed. And you might sit there as a baseball fan and wonder, how come people are getting 400 hits a season now? What's going on? And you might then go back and say, why did we make this change to the rules? That's changed everything about the game. And we could, therefore, remake changes to the rules, and then we have to let the game play out. So if we change the chemical composition of the atmosphere, that's like changing the background rules of the climate system. And then we let the weather play out in that new climate system. If we don't like the weather, we got to do something about the background rules somehow. So that's what I think.
Yeah, very, very good way of describing it from both of you.
Yeah,
from both of you. Thanks for that question. Paul in Elkhorn has an idea. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have a question for your guests. I've been interested and lived through many hurricanes in my life, and I was just curious about this concept brainstorm I had. If we got all of the military aircraft that transports and put shaved dry ice into these aircraft and dropped it all on the center of a hurricane, would that be possible to?
Ooh, we suddenly lost our phones. So, and in fact, all of our phones went off. So I don't know what happened there, but I think you get the idea.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. The notion of it's called weather modification. Is it possible to do weather modification on a scale the size of a tropical cyclone, a vigorous hurricane? This was something that was first considered seriously in the 1940s and 50s in weird ways. Actually, we came out of World War II and we had just, you know, discovered we'd gotten atomic energy under some sort of control. We had computers, we had radar, all sorts of other things, and we thought maybe if we could predict the weather, if we could put atomic bombs in the right place, we could discourage the attack of weather systems on one place or another. We were kind of filled with hubris after World War II. And in a similar way, I think trying to mount an effort on the scale of even the small scale tropical cyclones is just impossible when you come right down to the nuts and bolts. These things take cover, you know, hundreds of millions of square kilometers. They are made up of enormous amounts of water vapor and then small little meteorological or hydrological particles, ice and water. And to try and combat them with some sort of a scheme whereby you seed the clouds is not possible. And I think people in the field are ready to say that broadly.
So, Paul, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Greg is in the car driving and called but couldn't stay with us. They read a recent study about groundwater pumping that is changing the rotation of the Earth, wondering how this could affect the weather.
I don't know how that works, but one of the factors for weather in the middle latitudes is the rotation rate of the Earth. But you'd have to change it by an awful lot to have any discernible impact on the way weather systems get themselves organized. The Earth's rotation undergoes natural variability of a little bit. I don't know what Steve knows, maybe. Is he still on the air? We have Steve?
Steve, did we? We didn't lose you. Okay.
No, he didn't lose me yet. And, yeah, it does wobble, and that is on a longer time scale that often aligns with climate regimes. But, yeah, if you're pumping water out, I can see it causing problems because we've seen pictures in Arizona, I think it is, where you really see the land drop as they've been pumping water out for decades. But I don't see how those kinds of impacts would really affect weather. Again, the scale's just too large.
Right.
Too much
right.
energy.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So I've got a question relating to the Commerce Department. The National Weather Service is an office of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but NOAA is administered by the U.S. Department of Commerce. And I guess there's some reasons for that, John.
Yeah, they've grown in profile, in my opinion, too, because, you know, the weather and the climate, especially the weather, has a big influence on commerce broadly. And I think this has become more and more recognized over the last several decades, if it wasn't before. The Weather Bureau started out as part of the Telegraph Office, which was in the Department of the War Department in the 1870s and 80s. And it quickly became clear that there's a commerce side to keeping track of the weather. So that didn't take long for that to happen. Yeah, so Department of Commerce is a huge, sprawling agency of the government, and it does contain NOAA, and the National Weather Service is contained within NOAA. And NOAA means National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So we're keeping track of both the atmosphere and the ocean. And you can see the commercial the important commercial things that go on both in the atmosphere and the ocean. So it's a major part of the Commerce Department's purview is to make sure we do a good job monitoring the oceans and the atmosphere for our citizens. And, you know, maybe there's a bit of a push now. We got a nominee who is, from Cantor Fitzgerald. I think he's one of these people who sees the government as just an extension of business. The big difference there to me is that a government agency has a civic responsibility to the citizens of the country. A for-profit agency has a responsibility to shareholders. They're not the same thing, and they're fundamentally different. And we really got to be careful that we don't confuse government and civic responsibilities with responsibilities to satisfy shareholders.
I saw the Project 2025, presidential policy agenda, which was, I think, drafted by the Heritage Foundation, suggested NOAA be downsized, maybe privatized somehow.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Steve?
Yeah, I'm going to give you my thoughts, but I also think John really made a really good point there. There's real difference between the fundamental difference between a government agency and what it provides and what a private agency does. And with regard to NOAA and National Weather Service, they're very much integrated. But with regard to 2025 and separating NOAA and the National Weather Service and downsizing it, there's no doubt we're about to go through some change as a country. And when we go through big times of big changes, whether it's political or social, I think it's really important that we have a sense of what grounds us. You know, what are our core values, both as individuals and communities? You know, what do we guide our decisions on? What's most important to us? What are the qualities that we strive to embody? And for me, those values include openness, honesty, fairness, objectivity, accountability. And I think that these are things that align with the scientific community in general. So when we read sections about Project 25 and see them smear NOAA as one of the drivers of climate change in an alarmist kind of way, it just does not align with my core values of honesty and objectivity.
Right.
The National Weather Service and NOAA are communities that save lives.
Yeah.
They collect data, they distribute it in honest and objective ways. And the forecasts that they make are not from a political point of view. They are not ideological. They are based on data and facts, and they save lives. They help people, their homes, and their families. It's real. And so to downsize that, to split it up, to commercialize it, would be a future disaster for the United States.
I completely agree. And, you know, one of the main things that hits me, that was an excellent discussion, Steve. One of the main things that hits me is the whole notion that they tried this in the late 90s. John Boehner and a few other people wanted to privatize the Weather Service. This was, and Kasich was another one. And the idea that a private company, a for-profit company, would be as responsible in doing its forecast verification and thereby renovating their processes so they make a better forecast next time is complete nonsense. They would never do it. There'd be no pressure on them for, in a for-profit environment, to make a better forecast. Because if they're the only ones making it, they can hype the ones that are right and they can just forget about the ones that are wrong. The National Weather Service cannot do that. It has an obligation to get better and better and better, and also to be honest, as you pointed out, with the public about when it has failings, and they are increasingly rare. And so it's an absolute disaster waiting to happen, and I wish we could get the ear of some of these people at least to get them to think about this in a way that's a little bit less scary.
And I want to add, this does not mean that John and I are against commercial weather companies.
Correct.
They are extremely valuable because they do local forecasts or local forecasts for particular industries. The thing is, they use the public data that are provided by NOAA or NASA in order to serve their customers. So they're important, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. What company is going to supply for free that information to competitive companies? They're not going
to
do it.
And to the public.
Yeah, and to the public.
I mean, a lot of the data that we look at is freely available.
Yep.
We're not paying for it.
They're not going to do it. And that's going to be a real logjam of information, which will have dire consequences, as you pointed out.
Yeah. We, on that note, we'll take another call. Tom in Oconto has something relating to climate, I believe, with a name change, perhaps, Tom?
Well, I have a suggestion. Since there's all this conflict and everything, why don't we refer to what is happening as climate evolution, which is basically what it's doing, rather than climate change? Maybe that or change the attitude of some people.
The only thing that I would point against that is evolution to me means natural kind of activities, whereas what's happening right now are, it's not evolving. It's due to a change that we are forcing.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that, you know, the more we try to make this, more palatable for those who are just, you know, at this day and age, still skeptical of whether or not there's a problem, I'm tired of trying to satisfy the skeptics that there's a problem. I want to join with them and try and solve it and figure out some good ways for an industrial country like our own that has a desire to continue to make progress, to do it in a way that we can sustain. But to suggest that, you know, there's something broadly natural going on here in the last 150 years is, as Steve says, completely false. And so anything that gives that impression is detracting from solving this problem.
Jim in the town of Middleton emailed to ask you to discuss a mostly discredited report that there is a limit to how much greenhouse gases can be absorbed by the atmosphere and that it has already reached a point that no more CO2 can be absorbed.
I have not heard about that. I thought we don't know how much more can be absorbed by the ocean. We're not sure about that. But a lot of the water in the ocean's out of play. It stays at depth for thousands of years, and it won't come back to the surface for any reason until then. And so that might be the least saturated with carbon dioxide water in the ocean, but it's not going to come to the surface to be able to absorb more of it for, you know, a long, long period of time. I don't know the answer to that because it's not exactly my specialty about how close we are to saturation in the atmosphere, but I suspect we got a long way to go. I don't think we're talking about 400 molecules per million. I'm sure there's room for 50 or 100 more and probably 1,000 more per million because that's not a lot of space. So. Yeah.
Anne emailed to say they're interested in a large number of days that have poor air quality in Madison. The Weather Channel posts hourly figures along with the labels of good and moderate. Anne wants to know why we are having so many moderate to poor days as an asthma sufferer. Anne says this is a major health issue for them.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's definitely a health issue. And I think the reason recently has been associated with fires that have been going on in Canada as well as on the West Coast, and some of that and in the Midwest as well, and then that being transported over our area.
Yeah, and then as it gets colder, as the cold season looms as it is now, then you can have low-level, what they're called, is temperature inversions overnight.
Yeah.
And so the temperature actually increases away from the ground for some distance, and it's really hard to mix that air. It's resistant to mixing in the vertical. And as a consequence, anything that's poured out into that so-called boundary layer of air, the one that's right at the boundary of the surface, stays in it for a long time, especially in the mornings into the early afternoon on days that are otherwise quiescent. And so you have some problems with local chemical composition changes because of pollution, just regular everyday pollution, not the kind that's changing the background climate.
Hmm. Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, are weather guys from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Questions for them, join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. An email about meteorological bombs. And you guys, I think, had some information on this in a recent column that you wrote. What is it? And maybe explain that phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a term of art that kind of came about in the early 1980s. A couple of colleagues of mine had studied really rapidly developing, rapidly intensifying cyclones in the middle latitudes, the kind that affect us here in Madison, especially in the wintertime. And they came up with a threshold that if a cyclone's central pressure dropped by more than 2% of its average value in less than a day, that was an explosively deepening cyclone. And the word explosively deepening kind of started to catch on. People would say, oh, it's like a bomb. Yeah, it's like a bomb. So that's the word that's kind of in the press now, is the bomb side of that. And the one that just happened off the coast of California last week lost 6% of the average sea level pressure in less than a day. So it was 3 or 4 times stronger than the ones that struggle to qualify as bomb cyclones. This thing was extraordinary. And we saw one rather like it about 5 years ago. A graduate student of mine and I are working on that one right now. But this will be one that we have to work on. I'll probably ride this one to retirement, trying to understand this one. But it's a phenomenon that occurs especially in the cold season, and it's always interesting. Tropical storms can undergo the same kind of explosive or very rapid intensification. But to me, they're more interesting in the extratropics because they don't have a hurricane helping them do it. You know, it's a little bit harder job to do, but they are extraordinary.
They are.
So, John, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Associated with this bomb that just recently occurred, I started seeing the phrase bombogenesis.
Yeah.
Is that something real, or what do you?
No, it's, you know, I'm sort of a get off my lawn when it comes to vocabulary guy, right? But that's especially bad because the word bomb for a cyclone already implies Genesis. So you don't want to say bomb, oh Genesis. It's like saying Genesis, oh Genesis. You know, it might be a great name for an Irish kid, but it's not really a good description of the weather.
Okay. Well, Tom in Minocqua has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I had read some study that in terms of, like, climate change for consumers, we don't really have that much power because if we even went carbon neutral for a whole year, it would be offset by crude oil shipping containers in less than a week. Like, I don't understand what we're supposed to do with that aspect.
Yeah, I guess it's there's some truth to the fact that the individual consumer has very little control over, you know, how the global carbon dioxide fraction is going to change. It's determined by larger entities. But, you know, I think that the danger of succumbing to that sense of futility is that maybe you get less civically engaged and maybe you demand less of your elected officials and so on. It can be, you know, sort of the downstream consequences of giving up. And so from my perspective, and it's just my own personal opinions, I try my best to make the best choice I can given the circumstances of the situation. So some easy ones are I try to turn the lights off in my house. I try to make sure if I'm going to travel somewhere, I think about at least a little bit, I have the means to do it, think about a way to do it that might be the least impactful. Not everyone can. I understand that and I respect it. But you try your best in your own circumstances to make some dent. And then the biggest thing I really think is hold to account elected officials who are supposed to be looking out for the benefit of all of us, the commonwealth. And when they don't, they need to hear about it. And sometimes with a vote against them. And I think that's the biggest thing we can all do.
I totally agree with John. I think that's a really good point you make. That you're right. It seems like it's so futile, but, you know, things add up. And it's going to take time. We didn't get to this situation overnight. And it's going to take more than overnight to deal with it.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you for calling. Jeff in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Love your show. Hey, like, you know, I'm in the sustainability field, got solar, drive an EV, but, you know, COP29, the recent COP29 meetings, other things, we have the technology probably to slow climate change, but I don't have much faith in humanity. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I'm curious, are there any scientifically viable, I'm not saying you want to advocate these eco-engineered solutions to at least short-term reduce the climate change?
There are people who are very seriously thinking about what we call also geoengineering. I think there's another term. You used another one, and I like it, too. Geoengineering, trying to change something about the environment that would mitigate against the impacts of the ongoing warming. One that I know about is trying to put carbon soot in high up in the atmosphere that would absorb some of the energy from the sun away from the ground, or just trying to shade the earth a little bit. By putting some particles in the atmosphere. Now, the problem I have with that is it goes back to one of the callers who just asked us earlier today about hurricanes. How are you going to mount that effort? How are you going to do it? How much will that cost compared to, you know, making other decisions? And then the second part is, what control do you have over the distribution of those particles once you release them from your aircraft? You have no control at all. And so I don't think that the whole idea of unintended consequences comes to mind right away. You can't control what you're going to unleash in those scenarios. So I'm kind of skeptical as well. I don't think there's any particular solution there that presents itself.
Steve, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think the other one that I have recently heard of is putting glass beads or mirrors up in the stratosphere just above the tropopause with the intent of reflecting solar energy out so we don't get as much solar energy across the planet. But again, all the comments that John just said apply to that as well. You know, how do you do it? Why would you do it? And what are the, most importantly, what are the unintended consequences?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and there are some others about pulling CO2 out of the air.
Yeah.
There are some there's some work done on that, pulling it out of the air and sticking it in the ground deep.
Yeah, carbon sequestration, they're calling that. And that, to me, if you're going to fund one of these types of things, that might be the one you do, because you can actually have at the end of the workday an actual amount of something you took out of the atmosphere, and you've cleaned up a problem you know is part of the problem, and that's with some control. You've controlled it. It's a controlled amount. So I think that's a good idea.
Jeff, again, thank you. Marty in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to preface my question with the following. Several years ago, there was a microburst that occurred, and a friend of mine who's a pilot said, well, maybe simple terms, but basically it's a river of air and it's constantly moving. It's about 150 miles an hour. When a hole forms in it, this air shoots down to the ground. So whether or not that's true or not, my question is, last year, we live on a lake, we have a shore station, we were the only ones, lucky us, to get hit by this, whatever this thing, I don't know if it was a tornado, whatever, or a microburst, but the shore station, it got hit, and it pulled it up. It pulled the frame upward, and that seems contrary to a microburst going down. Any thoughts on that?
I think one thing that came to my mind is that, when you have a microburst that comes down, when it hits the ground, it runs along the ground. And that could lead to grabbing something and pulling it upward, not just smashing it downward.
Yeah, that's a good point, Steve. You know, you're exactly right. When the strong downdraft hits the ground, Da Vinci even had pictures of this. There's rotors on the skirt of that downdraft where the air is being forced to roll back. And so, and some of that air is going to have to be going upward. So maybe you got hit by the skirt of one of these things, and it started to pull this stuff around in the direction exactly opposite to what you might have expected. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mary in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I have a two-part question. Prior to this year, where we had a full Indian summer, for me at least, and prior to that, it seems like early in October, it would just get cold and it wouldn't warm up. And I was wondering, do they keep track of this fall weather?
Yeah, you bet. This was a really interesting fall. We had May, June, and July that were wet, way beyond the average, and then it stopped raining.
Yeah.
August, September, and most of October. 27 days in October had less than 0.01 inches of precipitation in Madison. 22 of them had zero. So it was an exceptionally strange October compared to the last several years. And you're right, Mary. In the last, I think, 4 of the last 5 years, or at least 3 of the last 5 years, we've had snow, measurable snow in mid-October, and not this year. And so a very, very different year. So I can assure you I'm keeping track. I'm really interested. And I'll tell you one last thing. The Northern Hemisphere, from September 1st to November 21st, it's when the last time I did a calculation was a few days ago, is the warmest ever Northern Hemisphere stretch from September 1 to November 21st in the last 78 years. And that's where I have all my data that I can make those claims from.
Wow.
So pretty unbelievable. So, and it conforms with what you just said.
Yeah. Mary, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Madison has a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. I got a kind of a technical question. I was wondering, if all the numbers we come up with for our carbon and oxygen levels and CO2 levels, all that stuff. How is that measured, and where in the atmosphere is that measured? I used to live in the highest city of the United States, and I lived above 10,200 feet, and we would travel and be on a beach in Southern California 24 hours later, and there's a huge difference in the atmosphere, just in breathable oxygen. And I tell people all the time, if you lay on your back and walk a half hour, 2 miles up, you start running out of oxygen. 3 miles up, you need a tank, you need oxygen to breathe, like Mount Everest. So where are these numbers measured in our atmosphere to actually come up with all these numbers?
Yeah, excellent question. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to say there are sites that are dedicated to doing this and doing it over the long term. I'm pretty sure there's one in Boulder, Colorado, that actually makes those measurements.
Yeah, and the famous one for carbon dioxide fraction is on the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. So it's at 10,000 feet. It's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The air is pristine. And your point, Mike, is a good one. The density of the air is very variable with height. So if you climb to a high elevation, the number of oxygen molecules per unit volume is going to be smaller. That's why you gasp for breath, you know, at the top of the 10,000 footers in Colorado or the same near Mount Shasta. Now, the fraction of chemical constituents stays the same all the way up to, amazingly, 50 miles above the ground. So if you take a bag full of air at 35 miles above the ground, which is nowhere, nobody's making measurements there routinely, but if you do that and you bring it back to the lab and you count the fraction of carbon dioxide molecules to oxygen and nitrogen and all the rest, that fraction's the same all the way up to 50 miles. The total number in that bag is not the same. But the fraction is what matters, because that's what the radiation cares about, is how many molecules is it likely to excite on its path in or its path out. And so even though we make that measurement at 10,000 feet, the carbon dioxide fraction is an accurate testament, because it doesn't change for 50 miles above the ground.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Mike. And let's take a call from Kristen in Eau Claire. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry. I wanted to ask your guests, I know that they said that they were tired of trying to convince the skeptics that global climate change is in fact occurring, but in an area where when science has been politicized, unfortunately, and when trust in our institutions is at a probably an all-time low, I would assume, how is there any work being done to try to talk to those people in our lives about how important this work is and how important it is for the future of our world, our children, for example, that we do address this?
So for skeptics who don't believe in climate change, are there ways to talk and convince them otherwise?
I think there are. I think that you can convince someone has as much reason to be skeptical about the force of gravity as they do about whether or not we're affecting the climate right now. And so a simple test, if they were allowed to, if you could get them to make the transition in their head, climb a tree and find the smallest branch and go as far out on it as you want without, and you know, are you going to believe that you're going to get injured? And if, of course, gravity will injure you. The change in the climate is a real thing. And it's going to injure us if we don't start to do something about it. And I think that this maybe talking about climate as background rules to a game and, you know, using other analogies is maybe the way to try to convince people at least of what the problem is. But I don't know what the magic bullet is to get people who are dyed-in-the-wool skeptic about this to separate their skepticism from their ideology on other things. I don't know what the answer is. I wish I did.
I think what we do know, though, is name-calling and insulting are not likely to work. And that it's going to take a while with individuals who won't accept what the data is showing, is to convince them that this data is real.
Yeah. And I think in the background, Steve and I have talked about this offline a lot. You know, I think there's been an erosion in respect for expertise. Expertise takes decades to develop. And the fact that people who are, you know, not experts and haven't spent that time, haven't done their homework, are the ones who are calling the shots on things like this and getting more of the general population's attention is not only frustrating, but it's dangerous. And I like to put away the frustration part because that's personal. But the danger part is all of us are going to share in that danger. And so we're trying our best to be honest brokers of the information and the expertise about that information that we've both developed over 3+ decades to try and tell people what we think is going on. And I think all of our colleagues are involved in the same way with the same spirit.
And on that note, I want to thank you both again for being with us, and we will look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Yep, thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Stay dry, Steve.
Yeah, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have them with us today. A big thanks to them, and a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.